session, Judge Hooten, Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This morning, the first matter on the calendar is in the matter of the welfare of the child of KLW. And counsel, you each will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The petitioner appellate will have just time for a rebuttal of 5 minutes. You can adjust the podium up and down. I do want to remind both parties today that this matter is being recorded and the recording will be available to the public. So please keep that in mind when referring to the minor child as you proceed in your oral argument and either say the child or use the initials. At this time then, are you ready to proceed?
Yes,
all right,
Your Honor.
You may do so.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Merchant, and I represent the appellant, Kyle Wagner. I'd like to begin my argument by highlighting the department's acknowledgement on page 26 of its brief that any concerns about Mr. Wagner sexually abusing his son, quote unquote, do not exist. This concession frames, in a broad sense, the arguments made in my brief that first, the juvenile court abused its discretion in not maintaining the parent-child relationship when Mr. Wagner is both the natural and non-custodial parent, and second, that there was not clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Wagner was palpably unfit to parent or that it was contrary to the best interests of his son to be in Mr. Wagner's care.
Could we go back to this page 26 citation that you're making? What exactly? I mean, I'm looking at that page now in the respondent's brief.
Yes, it says says that any concerns about Mr. Wagner sexually abusing KW do not exist. I believe it's in the second paragraph of page 26.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to.
Sure, Judge Hooten.
All right.
These arguments are also made in the context that there is no indication in the juvenile court's termination order that the court was aware that the law presumes a natural parent is fit and suitable to be entrusted with the care of his child and the presumption that it is normally in the best interest of a child to be in the care of the natural parents, a presumption the Minnesota Supreme Court has described as heavy and has said should not be lightly disregarded.
So in other words, you're faulting the district court for not citing the case law on that point.
I'm faulting the juvenile court, Judge Reyes, for not making any finding that would rebut that presumption and, in fact, showing no awareness that the juvenile court was even aware that that presumption existed, which should certainly be part of the judge's analysis for purposes of determining whether there was sufficient evidence to establish the two statutory grounds at issue here, palpable unfitness and egregious harm. And I'd like to, in that regard, point out to the court, with respect to the egregious harm finding, I'd like the court specifically to look at the addendum on page 9 and the court's findings, facts finding on 25. The previous fact findings before 25 all center around the court's determination that there was egregious harm in this case. But the court Then, without any other explanatory findings or analysis, just makes a summary conclusion that because there was egregious harm, this is in fact finding 25, that a reasonable person would believe that it is contrary to the best interests of any child to be in Mr. Wagner's care. There's no analysis with respect to why that reasonable person standard is met. The court doesn't even address the parent's care element that is discussed at length in my brief. And I would submit that that is an inadequate factual finding for purposes of the sufficiency of the evidence at trial with respect to the egregious harm grounds.
Could we narrow the issue a little bit? Are you denying or contesting the fact that the sexual abuse of a child is egregious harm?
No.
All right. So as I understand your argument, then why don't you explain what are you focusing on here in your argument that it's egregious harm statute does not apply to your client?
My argument in the broadest sense, Judge Hooten, is that any type of sexual misconduct, including criminal sexual conduct, in and of itself is an insufficient basis for termination. The court can find that.
In and of itself? So you mean we could never consider criminal sexual conduct as satisfying the egregious harm requirement?
No. A district court could certainly conclude that, and this court could affirm that determination if there is a finding with respect to the other two elements of the egregious harm statutory ground, or in other words, I'm sorry, just let me put it simply, the statute with respect to egregious harm. There's several other elements, again, if you look at fact finding 25, that the court simply makes no determination on at all, in the parent's care element and then the contrary to the best interests of the child element. There's
Is the finding or is the analysis as to whether such a reasonable person would believe it to be contrary to the best interests of the child for purposes of the egregious harm termination provision, is that best interest analysis different than the best interest analysis that's required generally, and if so, how?
Well, I think it's different in the sense, Judge Cochran, that it is specific to the issue of egregious harm. But the concept of best interest, I think, is the same both for purposes of a best interest analysis generally and what would constitute best interests for purposes of subdivision 1B6. It's a term of art that is used in the statute, and there's no discussion in any of the case law that I'm aware of with respect to subdivision 1B6 that distinguishes what constitutes best interests for purposes of that compared to best interests generally. So
argue that the court didn't do the best interest analysis for purposes of subdivision 1B6. What analysis, in your view, should the court have done in that regard that's different than the best interest analysis it did?
It should have determined whether or not that abuse constituted harm or some inability to parent Mr. Wagner's son as distinguished from the complainant who was abused that is not under dispute. There needs to be a link between the two. If the court will look at the Solomon case that I cite in my brief and which is affirmed by the Supreme Court, again in the TR case, cited at length in my brief under the in parents care section of my brief. The court says there that sexual misconduct should not constitute a ground for termination if it is not likely to have an adverse effect on the welfare of the child. So the juvenile court needed to do that examination, Judge Cochran. Did the abuse of Mr. Wagner's second cousin have an adverse impact on his ability to parent his child? Most of these egregious harm cases, the harm comes to the child that's the subject of the termination petition. That's, of course, not the case here. In fact, that abuse occurred before Mr. Wagner's son was even born. So there's no analysis with respect to whether or not the abuse of Mr. Wagner's cousin had any impact on his ability to effectively parent his child. And for all the reasons I state in my brief, there's an abundance of evidence that shows that he loved his child, that he was able to care for him, that he provided the basic elements of care when they lived together, that he wanted to continue.
But now you're getting into the best interest. It sounds like you're getting into the third statutory requirement of looking at the best interest compared to the best interest analysis here. But I want to go back because you touched on something that you're talking about in parents' care. I'm a little confused because in your brief, I thought you were less focusing on the best interest issue and more on whether or not the statute even applies in terms of being in the parent's care and whether or not it applies to the child versus a child. And it sounds like on that second issue of a child, you're conceding that at this point, that it can apply to the crimsex issue with respect to MB. But do you challenge also the statutory language of whether or not MB was actually in the parent's care? Is that or not?
Yes, Judge Reyes. There are three critical elements for purposes of a sufficiency of evidence analysis for subdivision 1B6, the egregious harm provision. The first is whether or not egregious harm occurred. And as Judge Hooten asked, and as I acknowledged even in the brief, we're not disputing that there was egregious harm for purposes of that statute. But the other two elements, the in the care of the parents element, and then in contrary to the best interest of the child element, those are two separate elements. And on both of those two elements is where I briefed extensively and where I'm submitting to the court here today, there's not sufficient evidence based on the juvenile court's failure to make factual findings. Again, look at fact finding 25. It's just conclusory. The court leaps from its determination that there was egregious harm to almost a strict liability type of determination. Because there was egregious harm, a reasonable person would not conclude that it is contrary. And then separately from that, which the court doesn't address at all, Judge Reyes, is the in-care, parents' care element. There's absolutely no analysis or findings of fact with respect to that. And for all the reasons I've argued in my brief, MB, Mr. Wagner's second cousin, was not in his care at the time of the abuse. There's absolutely no findings of fact regarding when that abuse occurred. For all we know, it could have occurred in the home when MB's mother was there. MB's mother never relinquished physical or legal.
Well, but didn't he babysit her?
He certainly did, but as the Supreme Court said in TP, the ordinary term of care, as in leaving a child in the care of a neighbor, which I submit is the functional equivalent of babysitting, does not clarify the analysis for purposes of interpreting in the parent's care.
Well, but it seems like you in your brief, you seem to equate being in the parent's care to being the primary caretaker, and I don't think that's what TP stood for.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, Judge Reyes. The Supreme Court...
What point, show me in the TP case where they equate being in the parent's care to being the primary caretaker. Because I think that that's a much, much higher standard of a primary caretaker. Even wonder whether or not if does that go to somebody who's a sole custodian, sole custodial parent? Is that that high a standard?
The jump site to the TPP is on 361, Judge Reyes, so that it would be 747 Northwest 2nd at 361, where it said that there the child's fractures and facial bruising occurred at a time when mother's relationship with father was intact. The child resided with both parents, and mother acknowledged that she and father were the primary caretakers for the child.
Right.
And then the court says...
That's a part of the factual analysis. But
well, the factual analysis undergirds the Supreme Court's analysis with respect to what the statutory phrase in the parent's care
right,
means.
But that doesn't necessarily exclude somebody who's not the primary caretaker from being in the parent's care.
Well, what the court says with respect to legislative intent is this. There is a legislative intent that the use of the term, quote unquote, care is properly understood in the broader sense of the parent and child relationship. So that, coupled with the fact that the parents in TP were primary caretakers, and then in addition, the Supreme Court's conclusion that the ordinary meaning of care, such as leaving in the care with a neighbor, does little to clarify the meaning of the term in the parent's care for purposes of the statute.
Right, but in TP, the Supreme Court was looking at what care meant in terms of the mother, not the father.
Well, whether it's the mother or the father, the issue is what constitutes in the parent's care. And the court said, one, that both parents there were primary caretakers. Two, that the legislative intent, when you look at the word care in the context of where it's used elsewhere in the statute under 1B2 and 1B4, suggests a legislative intent that has to be understood in the broader sense of the parent and child relationship. And three, that being a babysitter doesn't add anything to the analysis, to me, says that, I mean, I agree it's an open question, Judge Reyes, don't get me wrong, but I think there's enough in TP to suggest that being a babysitter does not constitute being in the care for purposes of the egregious harm statute. And as I said earlier, and then I see my time is up, I think it's a critical omission in the court's fact-finding that there's no finding whatsoever, even if he was a babysitter, that the abuse occurred then. It could have occurred when the mother was present in the household. And if you look at the psychosexual evaluation, exhibit number 23, that's the only place in the record at all where it talks about what the child claimed happened. And there was that it happened in the home at night in her bedroom. And there's no evidence that the parents were not, that the mother was not there at that time. And this court can't speculate on it. That's why there's an insufficient evidence to establish the violation.
Will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing respondent, Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. I intend to focus the majority of my remarks today on the egregious harm and best interest analysis, but don't intend to waive any of the other arguments presented in the brief. First of all, regarding appellant's claim that there's a concession that the child poses no risk and that that should frame this court's analysis, or that the appellant poses no current risk. That is a reference to the fact that at the time of trial, the appellant was within the structure of both probation that had restrictions on his contact with children, as well as within the context of the restrictions that the juvenile court was not allowing access of appellant to the child. So it's not a concession in the sense that appellant is presenting it. It's an acknowledgement of the current facts. And I think that opens into a broader misapprehension of the statute. Appellant is suggesting here today that this court, in order to find or uphold the egregious harm findings and conclusions of the trial court, that the court needs to do some sort of risk analysis. The statute tells us what to do with this kind of situation. The egregious harm, we determine whether or not the act occurred, and then we determine whether or not the child was in care of the person that we're looking at now, and then whether or not the nature of the act within the proper context, considering the act as well as the current parenting situation, that is contrary to the interests of the child, it is contrary to the best interests of any child that person should parent any child.
Well, could we just get, I want to focus on the statute, because, and it seems like I'm sure Mr. Merchant will correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, there's no contest as to whether criminal sexual conduct qualifies as an egregious harm. But the egregious harm definition goes further than that. It says the infliction of bodily harm to a child, and I think there's no argument that it doesn't have to be the biological child. It can be any child. But I think if we focus on the rest of that definition, which demonstrates a grossly inadequate ability to provide minimally adequate parental care. I think that's what's being contested. So that's being contested, and then I understand that the statute also provides that it has to be egregious harm such that a reasonable person would believe it contrary to the best interest of the child or any child to be in the parent's care. So if we focus on those two points that were raised by the appellant here today, what in this record and in this order supports your contention that there was sufficient evidence and that the judge dealt and that there was evidence sufficient to satisfy this definition?
The egregious harm definition in 260C301?
As well as the statute itself.
In 260C007,
right. If you can point to what in the record do you believe supports the judge's determination that there was egregious harm sufficient the basis of the termination of parental rights.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I'm sorry for interrupting. That the trial court did do exactly what the case law that has interpreted this statute asks us to do, which is looked at the context of the bodily harm to the victim, MB in this situation, as well as the context of appellant as a parent. And I would step to the side a little bit, Your Honor, because I do think today, as in his brief, appellant is suggesting that there is some sort of different analysis if the victim is not the child of the parent who is subject to the juvenile protection matter. The reference to TP as well as to some of the way appellant deals with this court's cases, ALS, ALF and AS, suggests that there's some sort of different analysis. TP is about when we don't know who committed the harm. As the court has pointed out, we know who committed the harm to the victim child, MB, here. So I think to this extent that TP is talking about how we determine whether or not the child was in care, that is not at issue here, despite appellant's continued suggestion here today.
Okay, but I think what he's arguing is there needs to be some kind of link. Where in this order has the district court made a link, or is a yep. link even necessary?
I don't think the type of link that appellant is saying is necessary. I think what the court has to do is what the court did, which was examine the context of the egregious harm, and the court did. The court made findings that MB and the egregious harm of the other child. So the court made findings that MB suffered. The court cited the cases that talk about what in care means.
Well, and I don't think there's any issue about MB suffering egregious harm. I think what counsel is arguing that how does that transfer to this child, his biological child?
Yes, and the
let's look at the court's order and
right.
Show us in the court's order where that analysis was done in terms of a determination that a reasonable person would believe it contrary to the best interests of any child to be in the parent's care based on the egregious harm in this case.
Well, the court does make a sort of what I would call an ultimate fact finding in 25, but the court talks about the egregious harm that MB testifies, and I think I understand that the court doesn't want me to focus on MB, but I think what the case law and the definition talks about is that we view the parent, the continuum of the parent's behavior that includes all actions that are in care of children. And therefore, I think that the behavior with MB needs to be viewed as a whole with the behavior as to this child, KJW. And the court talks specifically about MB, about the continuum of appellant's behavior towards MB, talks about appellant's current parenting, current attitudes towards the egregious harm, towards what he did. And his lack of self-awareness, his lack of full engagement with the social services that were offered to him to engage with that behavior so that he could change his circumstances, change that sort of arc of his parenting continuum. And the court talks specifically about the psychosexual assessment and credits the fact that appellant during his probation, so which was designed to address that behavior, that problematic parenting behavior, talks about how he did not engage with services, continues to show a lack of awareness and a self-serving attitude. The court also talks about the mother of the child, her testimony regarding both appellant's behavior with MB to a certain extent, because she talks about how appellant presented the relationship with MB to her as a caregiving relationship, and then her two different sets of observations, appellant's behavior as a parent, which JC, the mother, found to be deficient, and then also appellant's behavior towards her, which indicates, and I think the court did make findings about this, that indicates an ongoing sort of pattern of a behavior that is not, that would lead a reasonable person to believe that appellant should not be parenting any child. It's exploitive behavior. It's behavior that does not focus on the child, but focuses on the parent, but focuses on his needs. And it's behavior that would lead to problematic parenting in the future if he's not able to change that. So that's, and then the court concluded that it was likely to persist into the reasonably foreseeable future. So I think that those are the things the court needs to do. It needs to look at that whole continuum, and the court did that.
I have a question for you along those lines, counsel. So given all the information you provided in terms of his relationship with the child, his relationship with the other parent, do we even need to look at his conduct with respect to MB, or is that still necessary?
I think it's still part. Need to? I don't know. I don't think the statute sets up a test. I don't think there are rules that speak to exactly what needs to happen.
Yeah, let me rephrase it. Do you think the county still can meet the clear and convincing evidence standard based on all the evidence that you talked about up to this point, putting aside the evidence with respect to MB?
I think to a certain extent, but I think that the statute does tell us that we need to view the parent's behavior on that continuum of behavior, and that there needs to be, if we're talking about the egregious harm statutory basis in 260C301, that we do need to talk to a certain extent about what happened to the victim child, that's the continuum of behavior we're talking about, looking at what is concerning about this person's behavior in a parental role, and so then looking back at that egregious harm as part of the analysis.
Well, another point raised is that there was nothing in this record that indicates that he ever played a parental role to MB.
And that would be the in care of analysis. It's a parental role, not acting as a parent, but in a caregiving role. And so I think that the in care analysis is part of one of the things that we do when we're a parent is be in care of children. And that's the that's the part of his behavior regarding another child, MB, the victim child, that we need to look at under the statute. And then look at his wider range of parenting behavior.
But is there anything you can point to then in the order that addresses that issue?
Which issue, Your Honor?
That MB was in his care.
The order in the court's egregious harm analysis, the court cites both the statute and then case law talking about being in care, and then talks about there's testimony in the record by both MB and actually JC, the mother of the child in our case, that appellant talked about himself as being in that household, being part of that household, helping out, being in care. And then MB talks about appellant being regularly in that household, that she was expected to do certain things, do certain behaviors when appellant was there, indicating that he was in a sort of role of authority towards her. And I think all of those factors talk about whether or not she was in care of him at the time she experienced that sexual abuse. I think the statute itself speaks to that somewhat, given her age, the age range, and the fact that she at that time would not be expected to be in care of herself in that same way. But the most compelling things are those details about appellant being part of that household, helping out, helping his cousin out, and being in that sort of caregiving authoritative role towards the victim, MB. And that the abuse, I think, not dispositive, but I think also relevant, is that the abuse occurred in the home, in that family's home, indicating, again, parental or caregiving roles or caregiving responsibilities and an exploitive, egregious violation of the duty of care, of the care that we expect a person who's in care of a minor to provide. I would just like to briefly touch on the best interest analysis. I do think that that the best interest analysis, I'm sure as this court is well aware, although best interests are referred to in the egregious harm definition, it is clearly a separate analysis. And this court has deference, as the court knows, to the trial court's findings relevant to that. And I think the trial court did do that, made that second or separate analysis well with the best interests. The court noted that appellant clearly demonstrated or professed a caring and love for the child, but that appellant had a relatively minimal interest or expressed that interest differently or without compelling basis, in that he had not parented particularly actively when he was living in the same home as this child. There is testimony in the record about that from the mother, that he had not sought formal custody, that he had not taken grounds to establish child support, and that he, again, tended to use the relationship with the child to get other things, to get access to the mother, JC, to get access to her home, to continue whatever it was that he was getting out of that particular relationship.
Can I ask you to respond to another argument that was made by counsel, that if you just, if there is egregious harm to a child, and just by virtue of that fact, that it's sufficient to constitute a basis for termination? He's saying that if you'd interpret it that way, that it's just a per se rule, and so if there's egregious harm, that's the end of, you're basically saying that's the end of the analysis.
I think the trial courts always have to do a separate best interest analysis, even if the egregious harm statutory ground is met. I think that there could possibly be some egregious harm violations that in and of themselves are sufficient without any further analysis to meet the egregious harm definition. That's not an issue here. I think this is definitely a situation where there needs to be a broader contextual analysis, and that's what the trial court did. I would strongly dispute the suggestion that either in its egregious harm analysis, and certainly not in the best interest analysis, that the trial court just said the egregious harm happened. The trial court was looking at this parent's continuum of behavior and ability to be a parent. There was testimony, not just from the victim, but really compellingly from the mother, about how having this person in the child's life was severely detrimental to the child, both in the past and then projecting going forward. And I think the trial court really properly focused on those elements. See, my time is up. Thank you.
A I'm not going to belabor my argument with respect to the insufficiency of the evidence based on the lack of findings by the court in its egregious harm analysis, but just to reiterate, if the court will look at the addendums from pages 5 through 9, all but fact-finding 25 concerned the issue of whether or not there's egregious harm, which is not disputed. All of the other analysis is lacking, and counsel's argument that these other fact findings were used for purposes of a subdivision 1B6 analysis and termination are just not borne out by the record. Counsel also makes a big point both here this morning and in her brief that context is important. And I agree, context is important. And that's why here, when Mr. Wagner, as a non-custodial parent, and the presumption that a natural parent is normally the best person to care for a parent, is critical here for purposes of looking at the sufficiency of the evidence. There's no dispute here, as there are often in these type of cases, whether or not the child is in a safe environment, whether or not the child is in a stable environment. Counsel, he is. The department concluded that he was by virtue of looking into Ms. Chamberlain's status and allowing the child to remain there. The evidence shows that Mr. Wagner, in the context as a non-custodial parent, was able to provide day-to-day care when they lived together, when he visited, he was with the child. Ms. Chamberlain says that he wasn't always engaged. I would submit there's no case law.
Well, but that goes to the sufficiency of the evidence argument you have there. That goes to credibility. And we defer greatly to the district court's determination as to credibility.
Yes, the court does, Judge Reyes, but it goes to more than credibility. It goes to the whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence, because the
right,
court
I'm glad you raised the issue of clear and convincing evidence, because even if the district court didn't cite to the presumption that parents are fit to take care of their own children, the court is very, very clear as to the fact that the county and the state has the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence each and every single statutory factor, whether it's reasonable efforts by the county, whether it's best interest, or whether a statutory factor has been met, and the court clearly did do that. So I'm not sure that your argument that the fact that the district court didn't cite that initial proposition gets you there.
Well, under Minnesota Rule of Evidence 301, it's true that if there's sufficient evidence that is submitted that would allow a fact-finding contrary to the presumed fact, then the presumption goes away. But for all the reasons I've argued, there isn't sufficient evidence here. And with respect to the credibility determination, the clear and convincing evidence standard is whether or not the evidence is reasonably supported as a whole with respect to statutory grounds. Here, as a non-custodial parent, Mr. Wagner loved his child, he visited his child, he wanted to continue.
I have a question for you about the record. On page 5 of your brief, in the middle of the page, it says, following the investigation, the department made a maltreatment determination against Wagner for threatened sexual abuse. Was that maltreatment determination challenged?
No, that predated the petition for terminating parental rights, and the child protection investigator, Ms. Filani, testified there that that was based only on two things, the prior criminal case and her discussions with the probation officer. And as I also pointed out in my brief, Judge Cochran, the probation officer explicitly told the child protection officer that he did not consider Mr. Wagner to be a danger to his child. So I want to make one other point here briefly. The department said that Mr. Wagner did not engage with the social services offered him. First of all, the department offered no services whatsoever because it requested and was granted the request to be relieved of providing any reasonable efforts. All of Mr. Wagner's efforts were done in the context of his probation, and I would submit if the and I would plead with the court to carefully scrutinize the record with regard to what Mr. Wagner did on probation. The probation officer said that he was adhering to his conditions and that he did everything that was asked of him every step of the way, including with regard to participating in therapy and sex offender treatment, and was completely compliant with that. And his therapist and sex offender treatment provider said that he was making progress.
All right. So, thank you, Mr. Merchant.
Yes,
I think you went over again, but that's all right.
I apologize.
We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory period of time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.